And welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today, we're speaking with economist Raghuram Rajan. Joining me today is going to be our guest host, Omar, and we're going to be asking Professor Rajan about some issues brought up in his recent book that won so many awards called Fault Lines. We respect Professor Rajan so much, and we're so happy to have him here. He is an amazing economist that we really think can bridge the gap and unite people who believe they're from different ideologies. So, thanks so much. This is the Logic Consortium with our interview with Raghuram Rajan from November of 2011. Have a great day. Please stick around. Omar.
Hey.
Hello.
Hello, Professor Rajan?
Speaking.
Hi, this is Jake Briskman. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much. My dear friend Omar is on the line as well, and we really appreciate the opportunity for you speaking with us.
Sure.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm good.
Okay. All right. So we'll just jump right into it then. I hope we can go for about 20, 25 minutes, no longer.
Okay.
All right. Perfect. Okay. And all right. In your book, you clearly lay out that the educational system has been a problem, a main problem and driver of inequality in the United States. That the population does not have the skills to compete in an economy that is increasingly demanding non-routine skilled work. And in addition to a weak social safety net, things have not been great. The promise and the idea of mobility in the U.S. is shattering. And you've also talked about how to remedy this problem, how we must upgrade the capabilities of our society and broaden the pathways to building human capital. But that these needed reforms, for example, providing quality preschool care for poor children, have upfront costs and there is resistance to this spending. So you've laid out this problem, the need to expend on infrastructure but a resistance to spend, and you've also said that this issue will lead us to a fundamental rethinking of the tax structure and incentive structures in our government, a change in the nature of how government services are provided. You know, as you mentioned now, the incentives in government are not aimed at using resources efficiently. Can you tell us how you envision some of these structural shifts? Is it a matter of creating the infrastructure and the plumbing and then moving the government out of the way? Can you talk about
sure.
this a little bit?
Sure. First, I don't think you can move the government out of the way. I think governments do provide some services, at least provide for those services, and you know they could do it directly. They could contract out. Sometimes the government is more efficient. Sometimes the private sector is more efficient. We really have to learn how to, manage the government efficiently. And that's the longer term goal. I don't think the idea is to eliminate government or to make it all powerful. Now, what is the problem? I mean, the clear problem is that over the years, our education system has been lagging behind. And you can see it in the fact that so many people are still dropping out from high school. So many people are not getting even a high school degree. And in this age where technology has progressed considerably and where there is global competition, it's very hard to earn the kinds of salaries that will give you a decent living if you don't have the skills, you don't have the education. And education is not just a matter of getting a degree. It's a matter of getting a degree in the right place, in the places where the skills are needed. I'm an economist, but most bachelors in economics aren't going to give you the skills that will translate into a really good job. You have to usually do a second or a third degree to do that. So in that sense, I think what we need is a better match between the skills that are produced in the workforce and the jobs, the higher order jobs that are being created. The worry is with things as they are, the kinds of jobs that people without a high school degree can get are typically unskilled jobs, jobs, you know, a low-level construction worker or flipping burgers in a burger joint. And these jobs don't pay well. So there's no point sort of, you know, feeling left out of the growth process if you don't have the skills. And unfortunately, for too many Americans, even if they have the willingness to acquire the skills, and many do want to acquire those skills, want to acquire better education, the early years and the kind of environment that they're exposed to make it much harder to do that. You grow up in an environment where the local school doesn't function that well. The kids who go to school with you don't have, you know, an enormous appetite to do homework, to get a better education, and those kinds of things stand in the way of people getting the skills that they need. So we do need reforms of the schools. We need reforms of the kinds of post-school skill building that there exists. For example, better vocational colleges that teach you skills that are, in a sense, that lead to direct jobs and so on. So a wholesale revamp is needed. We need to think through this carefully because it's not easy.
I understand the idea of really needing to tailor the educational system and the supply of skills to the demand. But I wanted to explore your vision of government outside of the educational and the idea that incentives are just not aligned right now, that we need to align the incentives for social good. Is it a matter of, I mean, can we set, you know, kind of an infrastructure with like a carbon tax and eliminate some big of agencies of the government? Or I'm trying to see where we want to take this about slimming down and getting the bad part of the incentives out of government now.
Right. Well, sometimes the incentive is to tailor government programs too narrowly, right? I mean, we've seen an example of that with the financing that's gone to ethanol, which, you know, to some extent, ethanol produced in the United States is not a particularly efficient way of you know, producing renewable fuel sources, and you know, it consumes a lot of taxpayer money. Similarly, we've handed out financing subsidies to some of these solar companies, and Solyndra is an example of a company that has gone bust. The government trying to pick technologies often doesn't work well. For the government to decide this is the one I fund and that is the one I don't, it's better for the private sector, which has its own money at stake, to make those kinds of decisions. And so if we wanted, for example, to enhance the growth of the renewable energy industries, which is a potential area of technological development for the United States, perhaps a far better way of doing that would be to impose an energy tax. Why is an energy tax useful? Because it says that even if the price of petrol falls really low, you still will have to pay some amount for petrol, for gasoline, and that will give the alternative energy producers some cushion, some stability in the pricing of gas, which is their main competitor, and as a result, they have greater incentive to innovate, knowing that the price of gas will not fall below this floor. So by putting an energy tax, first you recognize that energy sources like gas or oil are polluting, and therefore you're trying to, in a sense, penalize what economists call the externality. But also you're giving a chance for the alternative energy producers to to see that there is some stability in energy prices. And you're not picking and choosing one particular source of alternative energy. You are saying, let anybody try it. Let the wind producers try it. Let the solar energy guys try it. And whoever has a better technology will win in the end. All I'm doing is ensuring that they have some stability in prices by placing a tax, which is necessary given the extent to which traditional energy sources pollute.
I see. I definitely see. Omar, do you want to ask something? Omar's going to get into a little bit of different topic, and then we might come back to the kind of the role of government and the fracture of the dialogue.
Okay.
Professor Arjun, I just had a question in connection with the final three chapters in your book, which really deal with the credit crisis and the financial meltdown and banking in particular. And I think even though you do recognize most of the flaws that people who have been critical of the bank, such as the failures of risk management or the perverse incentives that were there in terms of pay or government encouragement in terms of making all these risky investments, I think the thrust of your whole argument goes back to what is, I think, throughout the book, which is that this is all systemic, and the system itself encouraged the idea of taking the tail risks. And I think what we have learned very recently is that a lot of the time, some of the banks were conscious of the fact that these were tail risks and that there was going to be an implosion. So, for instance, Deutsche Bank went short on the subprime market in 2005. And Goldman similarly realized very early on, around 2007, that the market was going to implode, which is why it also went short. And now we have this new crisis, which deals with the banks themselves realizing, at least those two, and now it seems that with the SEC settlements, even with Citigroup and JP Morgan Chase, there's a realization on their part that the market is going to implode, and they decide to go short on many of these investments, and then they start creating these CDOs that are designed to fail, where there is this impression that there's an independent collateral manager, but there are many allegations now being raised that the collateral managers were either fig leaves or that they were colluding with the banks. And obviously this has generated many lawsuits based on fraud. But I think tying this into your thesis, do you think that in some sense this shows, one, that the banks were conscious of the tail risks and decided to take advantage of other people on that basis, at least some of them, such as Deutsche and Goldman, who may have been, I think, exposed to the contagion later on, but they remain pretty healthy all the way up to 2008. And second, do you think that this also shows that that you cannot blame the government for everything, and that the bankers do deserve the blame for a lot of it in hindsight, now that we know about the CDO crisis, because of the fact that the government knew nothing about the fact that they were constructing these deals to fail, and that it couldn't have been systemic, but it was basically a creation of their own?
No, first, I'm not in any way saying that it's all a problem of the government. I think the anybody reading the book closely will see that I say there is enough blame to spread, and the bankers also, and certainly there will be clear cases of criminal activity. There will be cases of activity which are less clear. And one of the things you must remember is that despite having a democratic administration, which was at least a little removed from the financial sector, we haven't had large-scale criminal prosecutions of the financial sector. Now, you may say that is because the government is in bed with the financial sector once again, and that is why we haven't had these prosecutions. Or you may argue that it's harder pointing to specific instances of criminal activity, which will lead to easy prosecution in courts. And the fact that we haven't had these large-scale prosecutions and banker after banker being sent to jail is because the evidence is not so clear that they, in fact, undertook criminal activity. And in fact, the SEC settlements, which are for substantial sums of money, may be because the SEC can't really prove that clearly and that effectively that, in fact, that's what took place. Now, you know, I don't want to take a stand on which of these is right, whether the current government is in cahoots with the bankers or whether the case is much harder. My sense is it's probably the second, which suggests that if you think that these activities were wrong, which I think they were, then there is something fundamentally flawed with the system, and it's not just a question of criminal activity. Now, that said, I think shorting selling tail risk rather than loading up on it is the way a healthy market works. That there have to be people who think the system is taking too much risk on one side to, in a sense, equalize the price of risk. It's when everybody thinks there's no risk involved, when everybody's loading up on mortgage-backed securities, thinking they will never default, that you have a problem, because then I think the risk is not being priced. It's only when you have enough people on the other side saying, oh, you guys are crazy, you're taking risks you shouldn't be taking because these mortgage owners will default and therefore we're going to short this, that you've got a healthy system. So one-sided bets are not the way we need to go. We need two-sided bets. Now, the problem with some of the incidents that you're talking about is that what people were doing was not disclosed. So, you know, to the extent that Goldman constructed a security which had assets that were chosen by somebody who wanted to short, that should have been disclosed to buyers of those kinds of securities, saying these have been specifically chosen and therefore are constructed to fail. I think, you know, that's in some sense sounds like a technical violation. It's probably more, but those kinds of disclosures need to be made. But the act of shorting itself is not. In any way something to be condemned, that is something that keeps the market healthy.
Right. But in this case, I think the banks themselves were pitching to their clients these structures as long investments while taking a short position, which would have also been fine, but they weren't disclosing that they were choosing the assets and the assets were bad.
I agree.
Right, and then but one follow up that I did have for you, and I think you discussed
but,
this.
But by the way, book. Again, on pitching your clients, if they pitch their clients saying these were good investments, that is both terrible business, and to some extent, I think you could explore. And I'm not enough of a lawyer to understand to see if that was criminally negligent advice. I think there are plenty of situations where banks themselves were holding on to this as part of their own portfolios. UBS is a classic example, and I think in those situations it's harder to say that they didn't know what it was in there. You have to, in a sense, look at the incentives within the banks also, which were completely perverted.
As a follow-up to that, I just wanted to know your thoughts on something that is related to what we already discussed. And I think with some of the banks, so with Goldman and Deutsche, the story becomes, I think, much more simpler because one of them we know went short very early on and the other one sort of recuperated and then decided to go short, which would explain why they would construct these CDOs and take the short positions. But I think one thing that is a mystery.
I'll just interrupt you there. I'm not sure we know Goldman saw this way in advance. I think the dating is a little difficult, but at least some of the discussions suggest that it was they were in for the ride for some time, and it was only as perhaps as late as 2007, 2007 that they thought that they should get out. So 2007 is pretty late in the game.
Okay. Well, for the ones that didn't get out, such as Citigroup, for instance, is there an explanation as to why it had all these illiquid assets and it was so heavily invested in these mortgage-backed securities? And it had a really big sum on its balance sheet that consisted of these assets. But now we know that there was some faction in that bank that was shorting these positions and then constructing the CDOs. Do you think that was just a difference between two different departments in the bank having a different view, but the bank generally still buying into the concept of tail risk and taking on these risky investments? Or do you think there's some other reason as to why that may have been going on?
You can only guess. My conversations with people from banks like Citi suggest that, yes, there was no uniform view across the bank. And this explains to some extent why, one side may have been shorting while the other side was going really long. It's very hard, for example, for a real estate division to essentially have been boosting real estate investments for 3 or 4 years and then suddenly turn around and say, no, go short, because essentially they sort of dealing themselves out of a job. And so there is an incentive to say, oh, this is a temporary lull, things are going to continue, and to keep investing, lending in that area. So I suspect the incentives within the banks, I mean, people have this sense that there is one big banker who has one incentive, and that's really what drives each of these institutions. The extent to which there are different incentives at play within large complex banks, and the difficulty for the CEO to manage the whole lot, the difficulty for risk management divisions to understand what's going on and to control that, and the ability sometimes for bankers to take actions that eventually will hurt their bank tremendously, but in the short run are very profitable for them personally. I think all those things, have to be examined in greater detail and do exist in these large complex banks.
And lastly, getting into the end, I wanted to come back to kind of the fractured dialogue that you've talked about in this country. Mm-hmm. And some of the division, as you've mentioned, can be characterized as the tax and redistribution camp pinned against mm-hmm. the anti-socialist camp. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that within these camps, there are inconsistent views. Like mm-hmm. One example you've given is like some of the older Tea Partiers saying that government is too big, but my Medicare cannot be touched.
Right.
And you mentioned that the big necessary reform decisions will have to wait until after next election, which will give the divided electorate an opportunity to reflect on its own inconsistency and send a clear message. Can you elaborate on this inconsistency and talk about the way forward?
Well, I think a former Comptroller General of the United States, Walker, has said it quite well. I mean, basically, the United States can't do what it's doing and afford it over the long run, right? By 2020, I think the government deficit panels have basically said that Social Security, healthcare, and interest payments will account for 2/3 of the government budget. And, that's an untenable level of expenditure. If you want government to do some of the things that it needs to do, and keep the United States competitive without sky high tax rates. So in that sense, much needs to be done to fix the system. Clearly, there are some areas that we do need to spend on, such as education, which we talked about earlier. Some of it means, cutting from areas where we spend too much on education. And not all education spending is useful or healthy. But there are some areas where we do need more, and restructuring it, repurposing it, as well as spending where we need to is important. But we can't do it given our current budgetary situation. And this is where I think we've got these incompatible sort of dialogues going on. On the one side, the tax and spend guys say, what's the problem? Let's keep our entitlements. Let's keep the social spending. And what we need is you guys to pay more in taxes. Well, the guys who are making more money basically say, we're working harder than any of you have ever worked. We're working, you know, 80-hour weeks, and we're the working rich rather than the idle rich. And your tax and spend policies ensure that you don't really have to do that much, and all the burden falls on us. And as a result, you know, they sort of will say this is going to affect efficiency, this is going to affect growth, this is going to affect innovation. Why don't we cut back on spending? And in the middle of all this, the elderly are basically saying, you know, don't cut our entitlements. We earned it. We paid for it. Of course, you know, in truth, they paid too little for it, which is why we can't afford it anymore. But the net result is we have these incompatible dialogues, and what we need is really everybody to compromise a little. It's actually not a huge amount of compromise on each side, and we can make sure with the right sort of structures, such as proposed by the Bowles-Simpson committee, that you can have more growth, create a more efficient tax system without a huge increase in tax rates, but at the same time have a little more revenue than we have right now without favoring certain activities which are inessential and probably not warranted anymore. And, you know, with a little bit of cutting on some of the spending that is now on the cards, spending on Social Security, spending on healthcare, without, you know, in a sense, compromising the truly needy. We can still give them a reasonable healthcare, reasonable Social Security, but we can do all this if everybody's willing to compromise. If somebody says, you know, don't touch my healthcare, and somebody else says, don't touch my taxes and don't touch my subsidies, we're not going to get anywhere. Unfortunately, that's the nature of the dialogue right now.
Professor Rajan, we've enjoyed your time so much. Thank you, and thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Bye.
Thanks,
bye.
Professor Rajan.
Sure. Bye.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium, and that was our conversation with economist Raghuram Rajan about some of the issues in his 2010 book, Fault Lines. We want to thank so much to Professor Rajan for coming on the show, and thanks everybody for listening. You can find more of our conversations by searching us at Logic Consortium, and we'll be bringing you more conversations and discussions in the weeks and months and other times to come. Thanks so much. Have a great day.